Let's now go to the third chapter, which is this one that I was referring to that is all about the specialness of water. So in this chapter, we're going to talk about several different characteristics of water that allow for life to exist. But even though the properties of water are that we're going to talk about are pretty different from each other, they really all result from the fact that water is polar. That's why I said in the previous slideshow that polarity of water is why you exist. Water is indispensable to life for the reasons we're about to get into, and that's why, really, when we look for extraterrestrial life, which we're always doing, it really amounts to looking out there and finding places where there might be liquid water. Because if there isn't, we can just go on. Okay, well, we see hydrogen bonding here again, but now we have a population of water molecules. They're all polar, and we can see that what I was telling you before would happen. When they get close to each other, each water molecule will swivel in such a way so that its partially positive end is situated next to the partially negative end of the nearby water molecule. And that gives the whole population a little bit more order, kind of like a crystal, even though it's not locked in place, than it would have if these were nonpolar molecules just bouncing off of each other. And that really matters. It makes a lot of things true that we're going to talk about now, starting with two. In slide two, we're using this tree as an example. An example of a plant. It would be true of much smaller plants as well, but a tree is a superlative example, an extreme example. We see, though, that in plants, or at least in vascular plants, which is almost all plants that have vessels in them, there is a continuous one-way movement of water through the organism. Water enters a vascular plant through its root system, moves upward away from gravity throughout the organism, and then eventually exits through the leaves. And that overall one-way movement of water is called transpiration. Absolutely necessary to the continued living of the plant, which of course is important not only for that plant, but for everything that relies on the plant. Remember, I was talking about producers and consumers. Consumers can't exist without producers, and plants are producers. But anyway, this one-way movement, like I just said a minute ago, is against gravity. Gravity is trying to pull water in the other direction, right? Water's moving uphill, though, here. And that can't ever happen for free. There must be something causing it to go against gravity, right? Water has a tendency to fall. Well, in the box to the right, we're looking at a very close-up view of just one tiny vessel of millions that make up the bulk of the tree. This is the inside of one tiny vessel. And you have some water molecules in there. And there are a couple definitions of forces of attraction that we need to talk about that are at play here. They're labeled adhesion and cohesion. They're both attractive forces, and they're both because of polarity, which hydrogen bonding is an attractive force between polar objects, right? As we've already talked about. So that the polarity of molecules is what provides the attractive force. Really, it's the same thing in both adhesion and cohesion as far as hydrogen bonding is concerned, but we bothered to distinguish between these two based on what the attraction is between, not what the force is. Adhesion is the force of attraction between unlike molecules. And so the water is not the same thing as the molecules that make up the wall of the vessel. And therefore, the force of attraction by hydrogen bonding between the water and the wall of the vessel is adhesion. It's two different things attracting each other. But cohesion, once again, co means share. Cohesion is force of attraction between molecules of the same type. So in this vessel, which has a vertical length, you have really what amounts to a long train of water molecules. That I call it a train because just like a freight train, the cars that make up the train, even though they're individual cars, are held together by the linkages between them. And in this case, the train made of water molecules is held together because of the hydrogen bonding between water molecules one after another. The adhesive force, though, the attraction for the water molecule on the top here to the wall is also because of hydrogen bonding. The molecules that make up the walls are also polar. So imagine that just above this picture, there's an empty, meaning no water in it at the moment, piece of this vessel. Well, that's what drives the train. It's kind of like the engine, because this top water molecule is going to be attracted upward by adhesion, and then cohesion is going to attract the one behind it along for the ride. And quadrillions of water molecules from the top of the tree down to the soil, into the soil, are being pulled as an enormously long train. Now, each of those individual hydrogen bond forces is tiny, but indispensably important. Since there are so many of them, though, it adds up to a large force, enough to overcome gravity. Whatever kind of tree this is pretty tall, seemingly, from the cartoon. But think about sequoia trees. Sequoias are the largest organisms that have ever existed, depending on how you define an organism, but much bigger than dinosaurs. They're just vertically oriented. And so they blow away any other tree, as far as height is concerned, or any other organism. It's a hell of a distance that you have to get water to the top. Well, if you don't appreciate how much energy that takes or how much force that takes, think about plumbing. You know, you're used to, if you've paid your bill, having water come out of the faucet when you turn on the spigot, right? Why does that happen, though? Well, it happens because there is pressure. There's higher water pressure inside the pipe than out, and therefore it comes out when you open the gate. But why is there pressure to begin with? What causes the pressure in a house's water pipes? You ever thought about this? You just pay the bill and turn the water on. The reason that there is pressure is because the water in the city, the supply, is above the house. And water is spilling downhill to get to your pipes. You know, in the plain states that don't have any hills, you see a lot of water towers in towns. They put the water in a tall tower that's taller than all the buildings, and the water spilling downhill is what causes the pressure. Here we have mesas that we can put water tanks on. You see them spread out around the city. But what happens if you build a tall building that's taller than the water tower? Well, you can get water up so high, but only to as high as the tank is. It's never going to go higher. So you build a skyscraper, Manhattan, whatever, you're going to have to supply that building with a dedicated pump that has to spend energy to create the massive force or the tremendous force required to get water uphill that tall. There is no pump running in a sequoia tree or any other plant. It's simply this adhesive and cohesive forces due to hydrogen bonding that does the trick. But it's probable that sequoia trees have evolved to be about as tall as any plant can be. Because if you make this longer and longer train of water molecules, think about lifting it. A chain is another example of a train. If you lift a chain that's on the floor at the moment from one link, it gets heavier and heavier the more links are coming off of the ground, right? So each linkage between two links is getting strained more and more the longer the train is. Eventually, if a plant were too tall, you would break the linkage, which would be like unhooking some of the cars from the train. The part with the engine can keep going, but it's not going to pull the rest of it. And that would cause cavitation, just an empty space within a vessel, and that would kill the tree because it would no longer be able to get water to the tops. So they're probably just about as tall as they possibly can be. All right, now to slide 3. We're looking at an animal that's walking on water here. And you've probably seen similar animals do this. It's kind of a neat trick because you know if you try this, you're going to sink. But there's a couple of reasons why this animal can get away with it. One is that it's spreading out its area as much as possible. It has these long legs. But more importantly, what really pertains to this chapter is that you notice where the legs are contacting the water surface. There's a distortion of the surface, and it almost looks like the water has a skin, a thicker skin on it compared to water at the depth. Well, it doesn't just look like that. That's actually true, and that's why it's tougher to pierce that surface, and unless you're using enough force to pierce through that skin-like surface, you'll stay afloat. Let me try to explain why that skin, so-called skin, exists. If we look at a beaker full of water, there's trillions of water molecules, which I'll just represent as dots. They are all polar, right? Water molecules in general are polar. So they're all attracted to each other momentarily they're all moving around. But as they get close to a nearby one, they're all slightly attracted by hydrogen bonding. Well, for water molecules anywhere other than the surface, so water molecules at depth, they are more or less equally attracted to water molecules in all directions around them. So they're being pulled to all sides, up and down, because they're surrounded in all three dimensions by other water molecules. But at the surface, those water molecules at the very surface are attracted to water molecules below them, because there are water molecules below them, but they're not being pulled upward because there aren't water molecules above them.
So that compresses the water molecules
at the very surface a little bit more than the ones that are at depth. And that's what the skin-like surface is. It's a higher density of water molecules because of hydrogen bonding. And that's enough to keep the legs from penetrating and the animal from sinking. Now we can go to four.
Hey, you have a question.
Go ahead.
What stops the water molecules then from just going down?
Well, they do go down, but only... What do you mean by that?
Like, if they're all going down, like, the inner stuff is, like, even because they're like going all over the place, but that stuff at the top's just going down.
But as soon as you get a few molecules deep, then those molecules are being attracted upward and downward, both.
Right.
And that's what causes it to eventually...
So they're, like, being pushed up by all the stuff below them, too, then.
Exactly.
Okay.
But the surface has a higher density because these very top ones are being pulled only downward. Now, in slide four, the map here, it doesn't matter where we are. This happens to be Southern California, but other places in the world where you have a large body of water and a large landmass could be used as an example. There's really two things I want to say about this slide. One is that compared to land, a large land mass, a large water mass is slower to cool and to heat. Now, both of these are being sunlit every day, right? And for only part of the day, and they'll be in darkness the rest of the time. But what I mean is that the sunlight's not hitting just the ocean or just the land, it's hitting both. So they're both being heated during the day, the water mass and the land mass. They're getting the same amount of energy input from the sun. But despite having the same energy input, the temperature of the water isn't going to go up as high as it will on land during the day. And it's not going to go down as low at night as it will on land. And that's because compared to land, water is harder to heat and cool. So if you were to measure the temperature continuously and then graph it, the water temperature would be going up and down each day. The land would have a higher amplitude. It would change more from day to night than the water, which is why a pool seems so much warmer at night if you've been in it for a long time. Okay, well, why is it that water is harder to heat and cool? It's because of another property that all substances have. We talked about electronegativity earlier. Another property that I want to introduce is specific heat capacity. So any given substance has a certain value for this characteristic, specific heat capacity. Let me define what it is. Specific heat capacity is the amount of energy required to change the temperature of 1 gram of that substance, whatever it is, by 1 degree Celsius, or 1 Kelvin, same thing. All right. So it's the amount of energy needed to heat up a specific amount of that stuff by a specific temperature change. And therefore, it gives you an indication of how easy that stuff is, or how hard it is, to heat that stuff up. Well, if you think about cooking, you put equal volumes of water in one pan and oil in another pan that's hot, what's going to get hot a lot quicker? The oil, in case you've never cooked. Because it has a much lower specific heat capacity than water. Water, compared to most other substances, has a high specific heat capacity, which means to make the same temperature change for the same mass of water requires more energy than it would to make that same change in a different substance, same amount of a different substance. Well, the ocean, I don't have to tell you, is mostly water. That's why it's harder to heat up and cool down, because of a high specific heat capacity. The reason this is so biologically important is because this means that the ocean is a much more stable environment, which is why, and we often forget this because we're terrestrial animals, life started in the oceans, and that's the only place there was life for a long time. Life on land is fairly recent thing, only within the last 700 million years or so. Just only about a fifth of the overall history of life. Started in the oceans, it's still plenty there, but it makes sense because that's a much more stable environment than land. So that's one thing about this specific heat capacity. Another is that right at the shore, where the land directly abuts the water surface, and I'm sure you've experienced this if you go into an ocean, temperatures will tend to be lower there than they are inland. And that has to do with evaporative cooling because of the ocean. And you can experience this. If you ride a bike when it's hot around here and you just happen to go by a lawn that's being sprinkled, you can definitely feel how much cooler the air is around that place where water is being sprinkled into the air. That's because of evaporative cooling also. So this brings up a definition of another property, which is the latent heat of vaporization. Vaporization really is just another word for evaporation, which is the change from a liquid to a gas. Now, you guys haven't had this week's lab yet. We will later. So I haven't talked about this with you yet, as like I did yesterday with my other group. But what is really the big difference between a liquid and a gas? They're both the same stuff. They're both made out of the same particles. What's the difference? Exactly. In a liquid and a solid, but we're talking about liquids and gases. Liquids and solids have very close spacing. Still a lot of space between particles, but not as much, nearly as much as the space between particles in a gas. So when we talk about evaporation, which is moving from a liquid to a gas phase, it's really just what's happening is that some of those particles are leaving that close population and spreading out on their own. That makes them a gas. It doesn't make sense to talk about an individual molecule as either a gas or a liquid. Only if you have a population can you have spacing between them and talk about a liquid or a gas. But vaporization refers to evaporation. And when water evaporates from a surface, for water to evaporate from a surface, I should say, requires energy. And that's what the definition of latent heat of vaporization is based on. So the definition of latent heat of vaporization is that it's the amount of energy required to change exactly 1 gram of that stuff from liquid form to gas form. And just like these other properties, you can have a value for any given substance. And just like specific heat capacity, water, compared to most substances, has a high latent heat of vaporization. That means water, compared to things with lower latent heat, are harder to evaporate. You have to put more energy into getting those water molecules to evaporate compared to things with lower values. And this, if you do bike in the valley, saves your life every day. Or even if you don't bike, it saves your life. Because when it's hot as it is in July and August, even walking around would kill you if it weren't for your ability to sweat. When you sweat, you're shedding your body of heat that you're gaining from insulation by sunshine. And that keeps you within lethal limits. It's part of homeostasis, the thermal aspect of homeostasis, which is thermostasis. By the way, if you do bike, it seems like you're not really sweating while you're biking. But then you stop at the Circle K or whatever, and all of a sudden, it just seems like you start sweating profusely. Well, actually, you've been sweating at that rate the whole time you were biking, and that's what saved your life. It's just that the movement of air against your skin while you're biking helps evaporation. More water is evaporated, and that's what takes the heat away from your body. Okay, now water, the evaporation of water, and this might seem contradictory, paradoxical, but it's true. When water evaporates from a surface, that causes the surface of the water left behind in liquid form to go down. It cools the water that remains, but it also cools the air into which the evaporation is occurring. And maybe that doesn't seem contradictory to you, but it did to me when I first thought about it. Here's why, though. Let's use this beaker again. You have a population of water molecules in the liquid phase. They're all moving randomly at their own speeds and directions. But what is it that I said temperature indicates? And we talked about it in lab. More specific. Yes, the temperature is an indication of the average speed of the particles of a sample. So each individual water molecule has its own speed. But if you were to get in there and measure all of them and then divide by the number of water molecules, that would be the average speed, which would be proportional to the temperature. All right? Now, if you're one of those water molecules, however many quadrillions there are in this beaker, for you to have any chance of going off on your own in the gas phase, I hope this makes sense, common sense, you have to, first of all, be near the surface. Evaporation occurs from the surface, not from the depth. So these ones down here might get their chance eventually because they're all moving around. But at the moment, the candidates for evaporation are at the surface. So let's just restrict our attention to the ones at the surface. Even if you're at the surface, it's not guaranteed you're going to escape, though. And escaping is really what evaporation is. But if you think about just the ones at the surface, what would be true of the ones that are most likely to be able to escape?
They have the most movement, they're like the hottest.
It's related to hot temperature, but temperature, remember, is an indication of speed. So the answer is the fastest ones. The ones that are moving fastest are the ones that have the best chance of going off into their own. And this is why, like all of these properties in this chapter that are special about water, polarity matters. The reason that the latent heat of vaporization of water is high is because of the polarity of water. Compared to a nonpolar substance, escaping is easier. I mean, a nonpolar is easier to escape because it's not being pulled by hydrogen bonds, which will tend to leave it behind, right? For a water molecule, a polar molecule, to escape, it not only has to be fast enough, but some of that energy of its motion needs to go into just breaking the hydrogen bond before it can then go off on its own. And so that tends to keep it from evaporating, which is why you need even more energy. Okay? But back to this reason why the temperature of the water goes down, that's left behind, and the temperature of the air goes down too. All right, keep in mind what temperature is, an indication of the average speed. We just said that the ones that are going to leave are the ones that are the fastest at the surface, right? So if they do, they're no longer part of the population, the liquid population. They're on their own. You've just gotten rid of the fastest ones in the group. So what does that do to the new average of the ones left behind? It decreases it. They're all a little slower. Well, average speed is temperature. So when you remove those fastest ones, you've made what's left behind cooler, a lower temperature. And you can easily prove how important this is by taking water as hot as you can stand to hold in a rag, get it wet with very hot water without hurting yourself. You can barely hold it, it's so hot, but if you then just flap it in the air about 10 times, it will be not only cooler, it can be much cooler than your body. Because you've gotten rid of the fast ones, they've evaporated, leaving behind the slower ones, and therefore the average speed is down. That cools the water itself. It also cools the air, though, because the air, before the evaporation occurred, already has some water molecules in there that are moving pretty fast. When you add ones that are just fast enough to escape the liquid, they're going to be slower than the ones that are already in the air, and so you're bringing down that average too. Well, that is, yeah, that's what humidity is. It's just water vapor that came from liquid somewhere, but it's in the air at the moment. And this is exactly how an evaporative cooler works, if you have one instead of an air conditioner. An evaporative cooler just drips water. A pump drips water over some substance that the air is drawn through by a fan. That kicks it into evaporating. It cools the water, but it also cools the air, and that's what you're interested in an evaporative cooler, because then that now cool air, it's humid air, but it's cool air, gets pumped into the house. Okay, so that's because of polarity, once again. I didn't actually mention how specific heat capacity is also because of polarity, or why the high value for water is because of polarity, but it also is. You know, you've heard of the old adage that a watched pot never boils, meaning that if you're in a hurry and you're trying to look at the pot boiling, it seems like it takes forever. Of course, it doesn't really affect it whether you're looking at it or not. But the adage comes from the fact that compared to other things, water is hard to heat up. If you have a big volume of water, you're going to have to put in a hell of a lot of heat from the stove to get it to a temperature at which it'll eventually boil. Well, before it's boiling, while it's still liquid but just getting hotter and hotter as liquid, the reason that it's getting hotter, because of the definition of temperature, is that the water molecules are moving faster as a result of you putting heat into it. But some of that heat goes into just breaking the hydrogen bonds between the water molecules before it can actually speed them up. Whereas if it were a nonpolar population of molecules, more of that energy from the heat source could go into just speeding them up rather than breaking those attractive forces between them, which wouldn't exist if they're nonpolar. Does that all make sense? Okay. Those are the two things I wanted to say about four. How are we doing on time? I still haven't bitched about the clock. I'll try to remember to do that. Five more minutes. Okay, let's go to five. This is another remarkable property of water that we wouldn't exist if it weren't true. And this has to do with the fact that unlike most other substances, water has a higher density as a liquid than it does as a solid. For the vast majority of substances, the solid form is the most dense. Liquid is less dense because even though liquid is still spaced close together compared to a gas, it's not spaced together as closely as it is in a solid. And density is the amount of matter in a given amount of volume. It's mass per volume. So if you have more particles spaced closely together in that same volume, then you have a higher density. Okay, and that's true in most cases for the solid version of the substance. When you melt it, turn it into a liquid, you're partially spacing the particles away from each other. And therefore, that same volume is going to contain fewer particles. The density goes down. Things that are more dense are going to be heavier, affected by gravity more, in other words. All right? Well, water is not like that. Most other things are like that, but water is not. The solid version of water we usually call ice. Ice is solid water. Liquid water we usually just call water. It's the liquid version, though. It's actually more dense than the solid. And you can prove this to yourself easily with a cocktail. You put ice in it, or not a cocktail, let's just use pure water so that there's no other substances involved. Ice water. You put ice into a glass of water, the ice floats, right? For just about any other substance, if you put a solid chunk of that stuff into a liquid batch of that same stuff, it will go right to the bottom because it's more dense. Not with water, though, because the liquid is more dense. The reason that that has biological implications is shown by the middle picture here. In a large body of water, like a lake or a pond, there's seasonality occurring, right? It gets cold certain times in the winter. And when it gets cold enough, some of the water will start to freeze. If water were like most substances, the part of the water that freezes, the ice in other words, would be more dense and therefore sink. Wherever it forms originally, it would go to the bottom because it would be more dense. And so in the winter, you would have a certain amount of ice at the bottom, liquid above it. In the next season, you would have the spring thaw because you'd have more sunlight energy coming in. And that would melt the ice that formed the previous season. But only some of it would melt because it would be at the bottom, insulated by all that liquid above it. And so that means you would get rid of some of the ice that built up, but not all of it. And then the next winter, you would add another layer, so it would gradually build up over time. And eventually, the whole body of water would be frozen solid, which would make it much less likely for organisms to live in it, like the shrimp. And remember, water is where all life started. Well, it also, one final thing about this is that not only does this allow for there to be liquid in bodies of water for things to remain alive, but when it's cold, since the ice floats, it forms a nice protective layer at the top, keeping the keeping the liquid insulated and keeping the organisms that live in it protected. So it's nice for two reasons. But I'll see you in lab.